Good morning.
Is that shining up in your eyes?
There's perhaps no other passage in the Bible that has caused as much controversy and theological difference as this passage from Matthew that is our text for today. As with the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, as I noted last week, it has been dismissed as impossible or irrelevant or simply dismissed on the one hand, or it's been used as the basis for being totally passive and accepting whatever happens, even abuse, as proper. Neither of these approaches is an appropriate reading of Jesus' words in these last two antitheses. But they are two passages that I think are needed as much today as they were in the time of Jesus. Again, as with the whole of the Sermon on the Mount, some see these passages as irrelevant, speaking to situations far different than we live in today. But as a commentator at workingpreacher.org says, the problem with this section of the Sermon on the Mount is that it is easily dismissed as that which can only apply to Jesus' time and not ours. After all, the Jesus world was simpler than ours, that Jesus' context did not have the complexities of our own realities, of global realities. Until we remember that Jesus lived and did his ministry in a Palestine that was a Roman province. Until we recall that the Gospels were written in a post-temple, post-Jerusalem, post-destruction reality, then suddenly Jesus' world does not seem that far from our own. So how should we read these words and what might they mean in today's world? You have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say do not resist the evildoer. Or perhaps more properly translated, do not violently resist an evildoer. Now, one of the things that we need to remember is that an eye for an eye is already a restriction from the kind of vengeance that Lamech boasted about in Genesis 4, when he said, I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech 77-fold. The Old Testament law restricted wanton revenge by the law of equal reparation, an eye for an eye, and even made provision for some crimes to be forgiven, cities of sanctuary to be established. It's interesting how many ancient cultures established places of sanctuary, like some of those that we visited in Hawaii, or practices that many Aboriginal groups developed to deal with offenses. But God takes this idea of equal reparations, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and goes one step further. Don't violently resist an evildoer. And then he gives three examples of what that might mean. Now, these may sound like just lying down and taking it, but in reality, they are far from that. For each of them puts the oppressor in an awkward position. And we heard that well explained by Christine on the first one. It was a standard accepted practice that a master could discipline a servant by striking them on the right cheek with the back of the hand. To offer then the left cheek was to put the master in an awkward position of needing to strike with the palm of the hand, an unacceptable thing even for a master to do. And while our translations are a bit more circumspect, most people own just two garments, a coat, an outer garment, and what the New RSV calls a cloak, or some call it a coat, but we really would call it our underwear. So Jesus said, if someone sues you and takes your outer garment, be generous and give them your inner garment as well, leaving you naked. Show how unjust your oppressor really is, and shame them. Moreover, a Roman soldier could impress anyone into carrying their gear for a mile. It was one of the perks of being an occupying force. But to offer to carry their load an extra mile was to put them in the awkward position of either appearing totally overbearing or of needing to refuse the offer, which would be just as humiliating, saying no to a lowly peasant. In each of these cases, Jesus suggests ways of actively meeting violence without becoming violent oneself, and yet highlighting the oppression and the violence of the evildoer. Remember, Jesus is here speaking to the oppressed, not to those who oppress. It was these words that inspired people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. and Dorothy Day and many others in their practice of meeting violence and oppression with nonviolent resistance. Walter Wink puts it this way, quote, "Jesus, in short, abhors both passivity and violence. He articulates out of the history of his own people's struggles a way by which evil can be opposed without being mirrored, the oppressor resisted without being emulated, and the enemy neutralized without being destroyed." He offers a list, Wink offers a list of possible ways to live this out, and he has a whole list. Seize the moral initiative. Find a creative alternative to violence. Assert your own humanity and dignity as a person. Meet force with ridicule or humor. Break the cycle of humiliation. Refuse to submit or to accept the inferior position. Expose the injustice of the system. Take control of the power dynamic. Shame the oppressor into repentance. Stand your ground. Make the powers make decisions for which they are not prepared. And recognize your own power. Be willing to suffer rather than retaliate. Force the oppressor to see you in a new light. Deprive the oppressor of a situation where a show of force is effective. Be willing to undergo the penalty of breaking unjust laws. Die to fear of the old order and its rules, or seek the oppressor's transformation. I recall a friend of mine being confronted on the streets of Chicago by someone at gunpoint who demanded money. And he said, "Well, I don't have any money on me, but I live over there. If you just want to come on home with me, I'll get you some." And turned and walked away toward his house, leaving the person confronting him dumbfounded. And they turned and walked away because they didn't know how to. They'd never had somebody act like that before when they held them up at gunpoint. He said, you know, he didn't know. He could have been shot in the back. He didn't know, but the guy just didn't know what to do because he didn't know what to do. In short, Jesus calls on his followers to choose a way of nonviolence, not meeting evil with the same means as those who would do evil, but rather in nonviolent ways that highlight the oppression and cause oppressors to make choices they would rather not make. During the civil rights movement, as we heard in the U.S. South, it was when pictures of the attacks with dogs and clubs on nonviolent demonstrators became known that the tide turned in favor of those demonstrating. And then Jesus goes one step further. "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." Now, really, I mean, don't you think that's carrying it just a bit too far? Love your enemies? Is that even possible? Well, not if you're thinking of love as it's so often portrayed in the movies or this past week on Valentine's Day. Jesus is not necessarily talking about liking your enemies, having warm feelings about them. He's talking about how you treat them. After all, Jesus says, the sun comes up on them and the rain falls on them just as it does on you. God doesn't treat your enemies any different than God treats your friends. Shouldn't you do the same? If you treat your friends well, if you only treat your friends well, you're no better off than your enemies, because that's what they do as well. How are you going to be a light to the world if you are no different than those that you don't like? Eugene Peterson sums it up, all of this up in this way in his paraphrase of the Message. In a word, this is Jesus, he's quoting Jesus. In a word, what I'm saying is, grow up. Your kingdom subjects, now live like it. Live out your God-created identity. Live generously and graciously toward others the way God lives toward you. Jesus, in the passages that we looked at last week and today, calls us as his disciples to live differently than others around us, to not respond with anger or retaliate with violence, but rather to seek reconciliation and respond nonviolently to offenses against us, to be faithful and sincere in our relationships, to speak the truth and be consistent in what we say and do, and to recognize that everyone is created in the image of God and is to be treated as a person of worth, even when we don't particularly like them or see them as enemies. Is that easy? Of course not, at least not all the time. And it can lead to consequences. People have been punished, put in jail, even killed, particularly because they refuse to treat people badly that others have labeled as enemies. There is a risk and sometimes a price to pay for following in the way of Jesus. But then again, that's what Jesus said would be the case. And one can find also many accounts where following the way of Jesus led to dramatic changes. Nonviolent action, as I noted earlier, eventually led to the Civil Rights Acts in the U.S., to the breaking of apartheid in South Africa, and many would say to the dismantling of the Berlin Wall and the crumbling of the Soviet Union. But there are also many accounts of smaller incidents. Back in 1990, a group of children's authors and illustrators got together and created the Big Book for Peace, full of stories both fictional and true, showing that the way of peace is an effective way to live in the world. The proceeds of the book were donated to 5 organizations that work for peace and justice in the world, most of them large organizations like Amnesty International and Greenpeace. But among those 4 large organizations was a little bitty one called the Lion and the Lamb Peace Arts Center, which was part of Bluffton College, now Bluffton University, a small Mennonite school in Bluffton, Ohio. It was because of their involvement in this that I have this stuff, because they had a big event for kids to come together with some of the authors. One of the stories in the book is the story of Seth Laughlin, a Quaker during the American Civil War who refused to take up arms to defend the South or even to pay for to have someone else take his place. Even after he was put through all kinds of punishment and torture, he still refused to take up arms to kill. And finally, out of exasperation, he was court-martialed and was sentenced to be shot. As they lined up for the execution, Seth asked if he could have a moment to pray and was granted his request. The author tells it this way. The colonel assumed that naturally Seth would pray for himself, but Seth was ready to meet his Lord, and so he prayed not for himself, but for them. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. As the soldiers heard his firm voice and the meaning of his words sank in, each of the 12 men lowered his gun. Accustomed as they were to taking human life and knowing the penalty for disobeying military orders, they resolutely declared that they could not shoot such a man. Seth's sentence was changed to a prison term. Unfortunately, because of his harsh treatment, he fell ill and died in prison. But his story, along with many others like him, continued to inspire others who followed in his footsteps. One of the interesting things that I found over the years as I participated in many ecumenical groups is that our stand as Mennonites against violence and for love of enemies is one that is often highly respected in other denominations. No, it's true, not everyone respects it. Some call it cowardice and wonder what would happen if everybody took that stance, to which the only reply is, wouldn't that be wonderful? In a world that seems to be increasingly divided, where labeling someone as an enemy is seen as the easiest way to write them off or treat them badly, Jesus' words speak loudly and call us to a different path. Yet no matter how hard it may be or unpopular it is, as followers of the way of Jesus, we are called to hear him saying, "You have heard it said, but I say."